From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. After years of trying to center the issue of climate change during elections, the 2020 presidential race is finally the one where global warming went from the margins to center stage. Climate scientists are warning that the November 3rd race is a make-or-break moment, not just for the United States, but for the whole world. President Donald Trump has made dismantling climate regulations one of his top priorities and has routinely denigrated renewable energy sources. He's encouraged skepticism on the science, reduced the idea of climate justice to clean air and water, and in the latest instance, installed a Supreme Court justice who thinks climate science is, quote, controversial. My guest is Antonia Yuhas, a leading energy analyst, author, and investigative journalist. She's an award-winning writer who has contributed to Newsweek, Rolling Stone, Harper's Magazine, The Atlantic, CNN.com, The Nation, and more. She's the author of several books, including The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry, and What We Must Do to Stop It, and Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. She recently organized a letter by science and climate journalists published in Rolling Stone warning against the confirmation of Justice Amy Coney Barrett. Welcome to the program, Antonia.
Thanks for having me, Sonali. Great to be back with you.
So you and I have talked a lot about the role of the oil and gas industry in politics. Specifically, when the pandemic hit, we spoke about how the sudden loss of demand for oil and gas, what that did to the industry. What role is the oil and gas industry now playing 10 months into a pandemic where there's a president who wants things to go back to normal, who's been a very strong ally of the industry, but really coronavirus cases are still precipitously rising?
Yeah, and I don't think there's been an election in modern history where oil, fossil fuels in general, and the climate crisis have been so much in the forefront. And I think we really saw that come to the head in the last presidential debate, where we just had such good questions from the moderator, including questions about environmental justice, frontline communities, the climate crisis, policies about how fossil fuels would be addressed in the different administrations. And each side has picked up on those strong differences between the two candidates. And the last, you know, the period of time since that debate, fossil fuels have played such a huge role in the campaigning that each side has done and the climate crisis that each side has done. So Trump has just been doubling down on his commitment to American energy dominance, to really tying his fate to the fossil fuel industry, and promises that he'll continue to deliver as he has on protecting the industry. And I'm going to stress the industry, because the policies that he's put forward have not helped workers in the fossil fuel sector. And frankly, in helping the industry, he's helped usher in their demise by giving them sort of everything that they've wanted, which has been too much of a good thing, which has led to overproduction, which has also harmed the industry. But in any case, he's putting forward policies that they want, while Biden has really stressed the policies that he will put forward on addressing the climate crisis, and with Kamala Harris addressing climate justice and environmental justice with a new commercial that Biden put out, which focuses on the Navajo Nation and solar power produced by local the local community to expand solar power to replace fossil fuels to address the climate crisis. So we've just seen the sort of preeminence of these issues in a way we haven't before, and the two sides seeing them as clear markers of difference in the last, you know, moments of the campaign.
How specifically are the oil and gas industries impacting the election or supporting President Trump? You know, for Americans who might not be following the threads of the money flow, this may not be a very visible lobby group. But for oil and gas journalists like yourself, I imagine you can lay out for us specifically how the oil and gas industry is campaigning for Trump, essentially.
Well, you know, there isn't one blanket oil and gas industry. Let's put it that way first. There are smaller fracking companies, there's larger big oil companies, and then there's groups that work with both or between both. So overall, basically, the oil and gas industry is one of Trump's largest backers, and it appears nowhere for Biden and Kamala Harris in the ranking of where they've gotten most of their money. So it's one of the largest funders to the Trump campaign. It basically is non-existent in the Biden-Harris campaign. That said, there are certain companies that are spending a lot more on Trump than others. So for example, Trump's sixth largest funder is Energy Transfer Equity, which is the company behind Energy Transfer Partners, which is the backer of the Dakota Access Pipeline. Kelsey Warren, who was the CEO of Energy Transfer, has been a longtime backer of Trump continues to back his campaign. The larger oil companies have continued a process that they did last election cycle, which is to really focus, to double down on the Congress, controlling the Senate and the House, and to put money there. And what I think is happening right now with Trump, with the policies that he's been putting forward at the federal level. So he's been, just in the last several weeks, putting forward a slew of, for example, staffing changes at NOAA, which does critical work on the climate, which are climate denialists,
National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yes, yeah. Thank you. just doing a slew of policies that have really put him squarely, even more than before, in alliance with climate denialists and anti-environment and a more right-wing even side of those groups. And I think that's to get money, but not just from the fossil fuel industry, from more, again, I would say sort of right-wing, more extremist climate denialists, financiers within the Republican Party, and to try to show them with four more years of the Trump administration, you'll get even more extreme of what he's already been doing. And I don't know that we're going to see who those funders are until after the election, because the reporting period won't be out until then.
When we saw during the debate the issue of fracking, specifically in Pennsylvania, being raised, how have fracking companies, thrown their lot down? Of course, there's this controversy around whether Biden backs fracking or not. And we'd actually covered that on a separate interview. But specifically in states, can you point out where the oil and gas industry or sectors or sections of the oil and gas industry are playing a role?
No, I haven't looked that closely at the at the state by state funding. I think it's fair to say if you look at the overall spending on the campaigns, which is what I have looked at, the federal level, as I said before, basically the oil and gas industry is putting its money behind behind Trump.
So you also have a situation where, because climate change is a central issue, thanks to the diligent and relentless work of thousands and hundreds of thousands of climate justice activists, do you also see it as an issue that is motivating young voters to the polls like never before? This is a very important issue to them, obviously. Is it one that's driving them to the polls?
Yeah, I think we're seeing poll numbers on what's motivating youth voters. And there are sort of three key issues, the economy, racial justice, and climate justice. And of course, those issues are intimately linked. And so, when they are turning out in record numbers, and these are issues that they're pointing to. And I think that climate organizing has also certainly helped not just bring out youth who these are issues that are of concern to them, but actually get them to organize around the election and to organize, their friends, their cohorts, to get out to the polls as well. And that's definitely taking place. I think it's very clear that this is an existential threat that young voters really understand, that young people really understand. And in this election, they're really seeing the necessity of acting on that by voting and by getting other people to vote as well. We saw it in the midterms in 2018, and now we're seeing it again here. And I think the clear link to the economy, you know, one of the things that's happened over the last several days, as the candidates have campaigned in Pennsylvania and Florida, is these two issues of, you know, will we tie our economic fate to the fossil fuel industry looking in Pennsylvania, or will we tie it to the green energy economy? And that's also looking towards climate change. So in Florida, you've got a state that's hard hit by the climate crisis. You also have a state where it's been, you know, sort of alone on the Gulf Coast of having its coast protected from offshore drilling. That's because Floridians, like most people who live on the coast, don't want offshore drilling. But Florida gets to have itself protected, unique to the Gulf Coast, because of its role in electoral politics. And so its political power is such that the voters have said, we don't want offshore drilling here. And the federal government has ceded to that, even the Trump administration, which threatened to expand offshore drilling to all coasts, with the exception, making the exception of Florida. In Pennsylvania, this is a state, it's so interesting because it's basically split at this point. You have almost an equal number of people employed in the oil and gas sector in Florida and in the green energy economy. The difference is that the fossil fuel sector is crashing and contracting, whereas green energy is seen to be, you know, the thriving sector of the future, and particularly so if Biden is elected. So on the economy in a state like Pennsylvania, you know, basically you're asking, is the future, you know, we've got these two sectors basically tied in employment, and is the future going to be moving into green energy where we see growth, or back into the oil and gas sector, which we see contracting? And I think that also, you know, weighs on this issue of if you're a young person who's looking at what jobs might be available to you, and you live in a state like Pennsylvania, the green energy economy offers much more of a sense of hope. And also, we're seeing young people coming out of college not wanting to work in the oil and gas sector. And that's a problem that the oil and gas sector is facing. Not only are they shedding jobs, but there's just less people who want to work in that sector. And so again, you know, this is an issue of, if you're looking at what's going to boost the economy, where does the future lie? Oil and gas is a hard place to say that that's a good place to place your bets, especially again, when you're talking about Pennsylvania, which is fracking for natural gas. Just last week, ExxonMobil warned that it may have to write off as much as $30 billion, and that's billion with a B, due exclusively to losses from its natural gas fracking arm, the XTO Energy. So that's a $30 billion loss for one company. And the idea that that's, you know, sort of the energy resource of the future, you know, is something that we should all want to question.
Right. Trump, one of his legacies has also, of course, been an extremely conservative judiciary, and that includes the nation's highest court, the Supreme Court, where he's managed to, with the help of Mitch McConnell, install 3 out of 9 justices, the latest being Amy Coney Barrett, who during her confirmation hearings refused to say whether she thought climate science was a real thing. So tell me a little bit about the fear that you have around that issue, because we may, of course, be seeing a lot of cases head to the Supreme Court where our climate policies could be set. And also tell me about the petition that you helped to organize that was published in Rolling Stone that you wrote.
Yeah, this is such an important issue. As you say, with the Trump administration and the Republicans in the Senate confirming a full third of the Supreme Court, now probably the most conservative court, 6-3 that we've had in almost 100 years. And as Amy Coney Barrett was coming up for confirmation and then the vote, final vote in the Senate, I joined with Justin Noble and co-wrote a letter from climate and science journalists that was then signed by 79 climate and science journalists, challenging Amy Coney Barrett's nomination on the grounds that she repeatedly refused over and over again in questioning to acknowledge the scientific certainty of climate change. She said she didn't feel that she was qualified to opine on the causes of climate change. She said, I'm not a scientist. She said, I've read some things about climate change, but I don't have an opinion on it. And further, that she didn't see how that would impact her role as a Supreme Court justice. And, you know, the science is clear.
And it's about as clear as whether smoking causes lung cancer, which she was asked about and she didn't have any problem admitting.
Yeah. So Kamala Harris did this very important line of questioning, which was genuine questions. So the first question was, do you believe that COVID-19 is an infectious disease? And I wanted to know her answer on that question as well, given her behavior at the Rose Garden ceremony of her swearing in, where she wasn't wearing a mask, where she wasn't doing any social distancing. She did the same thing on the indoor ceremony. And I wanted to know that question. So the good thing is she said, yes, she does believe that COVID-19 is an infectious disease. That's good. Kamala Harris said, do you believe that smoking causes cancer? She said, yes. Then Kamala Harris said, do you believe that global warming is happening? I don't remember the exact question, but do you believe that global warming is happening? And to that, Amy Coney Barrett said, well, that I can't answer. That's a contentious issue. I think what is clear is that the science on climate change and global warming is as clear as smoking causes cancer and COVID-19 is an infectious disease. Also, what is clear is that not acknowledging that is a sign that you are an enabler of of a line of false information that's been being put forward by the fossil fuel industry. And Amy Coney Barrett has had to recuse herself from cases involving the fossil fuel industry because of her father's longtime role as a Shell oil company lawyer and his role on at the American Petroleum Institute, the leading lobby for the fossil fuel industry. Not acknowledging the scientific certainty of climate change to me is enabling that the false information that's been put forward by the fossil fuel industry. But more importantly, we believed, and so did our fellow co-signers of the letter, as you say, that was published by Rolling Stone, that she is essentially saying that she can't, that if she is saying that she's going to rule on cases regarding global warming, and yet she doesn't acknowledge the fundamental basis of the reality of global warming, it makes it impossible for her to be able to rule on those cases. And those cases are very important. There's one already on the docket that involves Shell, BP, Exxon, every major oil company. And this is a case where states like California, where you are, where Boulder County, where I am in Colorado, are part of a dozen states and localities that have sued big oil companies over their losses that they've suffered from climate change. And the oil companies in this case are arguing to get these cases taken to the federal level, where they believe they'll get a better hearing than the state level, so kicking it out of state courts. The oil companies aren't arguing. They acknowledge the reality of climate change in the suit. The argument in the suit is liability. Should they be liable for these costs suffered by states and localities? But Amy Coney Barrett would come to this case without even acknowledging the fundamental premise, which is that global warming exists.
So, which basically leads us to believe that she's going to be voting in favor of oil and gas industries. You mentioned her father. She probably sways in a very obvious way on this issue.
Well, that's why she's had to recuse herself from cases involving Shell in the past. I think that, you know, what we wanted to make sure was clear was that it was an unacceptable position to deny the reality of climate change, and that this is certainly an issue that is important for a justice to have to weigh in on during confirmation hearings. And that's why even Brett Kavanaugh, who now with Amy Coney Barrett being confirmed, Brett Kavanaugh becomes the center of the Supreme Court. Just take that in for a second.
Wow.
Even he in his confirmation hearing said, yes, he was asked about global warming. He said, yes, global warming is real. Yes, it's a problem. And then, you know, moved on in the discussion. It just wasn't something that, you know, he felt even needed to be brought into question. And this, it's deeply concerning that Amy Coney Barrett is now on the Supreme Court and holding this extremist you know, climate enabling, climate denialist position.
Finally, Antonia, you are in Colorado, a state that used to be a swing state and that is no longer considered a swing state because Biden appears to be leading with a healthy margin. What are you expecting in Colorado on election night? There are people in, you know, states around the country that are going to be keeping their eye on what is transpiring. And I know you're going to be doing some coverage yourself around election issues.
Yeah, I think, first of all, gosh, don't pay any attention to polls that say that anyone's got it secure. You know, just period. you know, I think polls are great when they tell us, for example, why people are voting and what are the issues that they're concerned about. But, you know, who might be winning or not in a state, especially a state like Colorado. What happened in 2016 was that people who were unlikely voters came out and voted. And those are people who we don't poll and didn't know their views. And I think in a state like Colorado, that's still very much a possibility. You have people that don't necessarily vote very often. They're not active voters, and they might come out in this election, and we don't know which direction they're going to vote because this is a purple state. So I've been interviewing people, voters here in Boulder, where I am, a very blue area, as they were coming out of the polls. For them, key issues were the fires that we've been having here, climate change. I interviewed 15 people, 13 were Biden supporters, 2 were Trump supporters. I then went just a little bit down the road to Weld County, which is twice as many registered Republicans as Democrats. It's where 90% of the oil in the state is produced. It's the heart of the oil and natural gas area here. Each person who talked to me, and there weren't very many who wanted to talk, were Trump supporters. And for them, interestingly, in, you know, sort of the heart of this oil area, fossil fuels, climate change weren't an issue that they discussed. One Trump supporter had a sort of lot of harsh words to say, in his words, about gays, Pelosi, and immigrants. And then another Trump supporter wanted to express her strong anti-abortion views. And I actually think that's a really important telling bit of information. I think for Biden supporters, the climate, the environment, fossil fuels, ending fossil fuel dependence are key issues driving people to the polls. I think for Trump supporters, I don't think you see a lot of people who say, I'm voting because I want to protect fossil fuels, even in the heart of fossil fuel areas. They don't say, I'm voting because I want to deny climate science. They're voting for these other issues that I laid out, and also because they want to support Trump. And I think that's really telling. I think that Trump's doubling down on fossil fuels right now, again, isn't necessarily about voters. I think it's about his financial backers. He is so trailing behind Biden in fundraising, so far behind, that he needs money, and he's doing what he can, to get it. And I think, coming back here to Colorado, I think Colorado is still up for grabs. And I think that, you know, I'm really hoping that voters here are going to turn out like everywhere, not taking anything for granted, and make sure that they show up for the issues and the people that they want.
So you still think it remains a swing state, even though mainstream media has sort of deemed it not to be?
Honestly, it's just more that I don't, you know, my experience in interviewing voters was, you know, in the Republican areas, they're voting for Trump, and in the blue areas, they're voting for Biden, and we're a state that's split.
Yeah. Antonia, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I will see you on the other side of November 3rd.
Yes, thank you. Thanks, Sonali. Thanks for having me.
Stay safe out there. My guest has been Antonia Juhas. She's a leading energy analyst, author, and investigative journalist. She's also an award-winning writer who's contributed to Newsweek, Rolling Stone, Harper's Magazine, The Atlantic, CNN.com, The Nation, and more. She's written several books, including The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry, and What We Must Do to Stop It. She recently organized a letter by science and climate journalists published in Rolling Stone warning against the confirmation of Justice Amy Coney Barrett. And we've been discussing how climate change has become a central election issue. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.